You're the one with the file import problem, right?
Yeah.
You figured out how to do it. So to import any file, you go File, Import Raw Data.
Okay.
And then I thought it was like clever and figured it out, but maybe not. So we're going to import this one again. So that's not an audio file really, but it will. So here you can just try different formats and you can make an informed guess as to what it might be.
Okay.
So maybe your thing was saving in 32-bit, maybe it was saving it in float. You know, you can try different things and try it until you get it.
Okay.
So we'll say 8-bit this time. And you can say an offset to try to skip past the header, and you can say what the sampling rate should be, and then you say import, and in this case we're going to get okay, let's try this again with an empty project.
Could a geek like you write a script that would go random or go one after the other until something worked?
Well, it's a little trickier to tell when it worked than you might expect.
Yeah.
What you have to do is you have to look for some sort of rational spectrum. But given that Mars Volta is popular, it's hard to know what a rational spectrum is.
The Mars.
So I thought I read somewhere that it had a mode where it would figure it out, and maybe it still does. I don't know. But I did find this raw import, which would certainly be enough right there, even if it's not clever. So anyway, so do we want to do question answer? Should I sit down? What's next?
I got another question.
Sure.
Why don't you push that button?
We want to see what the PowerPoint sounds like.
Another 3-hour show that I need to chop out all the music shows. So while the musicians are talking to each other and all, I need to chop all these pieces out and compress it into a kind of a continuous concert. Can I just go in here and highlight regions and kink and
somebody asked me that during the break, and really it doesn't. So it's kind of lacking compared to Pro Tools, and you might want to use Ardour for that, because Ardour totally has that. I haven't used Ardour myself, but I went to an Ardour demo at Linux Fest in April, and the guy showed you take several tracks, you drag one, you slide it, and as soon as they overlap, it does this little crossfade icon thing. This doesn't do that. So for this, you could do it, but you'd have to be like selecting and chopping and pasting all yourself. So you'd have total control over how it would do it, but it won't like help you very much.
But Ardour is Linux only.
Ardour is Linux only, yes.
You could pull it off in here, though. You have to take chunks out and just do quick crossfades. But you'd have to pull over the...
You could put it onto a different track at this one.
So this does have some features intended to help you do stuff. So here, let me... So this is actually music. This is one of the planetarium themes. Okay, so what this has is a feature where you can select a track and you can say split. And so you see now what it's done is it's taken it down and made it into a second thing. And so it has some pretensions of being some kind of a lightweight digital audio workstation, and this is the sort of feature where you'd use that. You can split things down, work on it separately, swap it out for something else, whatever, and then glue it all back together again when you're done.
So if I want to take the second piece up there and pull it over, how would you just...
Well, I think you would just basically go up here and then delete it.
Just remove the silence.
Yeah, just remove the silence. There's no way.
What you were talking about in the first place, though, if you just select a section and delete it, it scoots the two.
So yeah, you have to do the split operation and then delete to make it move over. Whereas in something like I think Pro Tools, but definitely in Ardour, you can have several things. You can just click and drag and pull it, and as soon as they overlap, it does this automatic crossfade. And so that's really a lot more, what it would help you a lot more. Here you can do anything, but you're doing it by hand. A lot of work.
If you just delete between 10 and 15, then can't you take the silence that you've created in that area and remove it?
Can you interrupt for a second? Is Michael Heavener still there? Your wallet's back there.
Oh,
We'll do a drawing.
Yeah. Sure, come next month for that.
So what was the question? Because we can just select this.
Take a slice out of the top track, an indiscriminate slice anywhere.
All right,
out of
take a slice and then just hit the delete key. Bam.
That's what he wants. It shuffles.
Yeah. Okay.
So it doesn't crossfade it, but no.
It doesn't crossfade it.
I can highlight that now. Low pass.
You were the impetus for it.
Right. And there might be some kind of a... You know, I'm not sure what repair is supposed to do, but there might be some kind of a thing intended to help you. Mm-hmm. But again, it's not going to be at the level of...
Crossfade in and out down below, I think, might...
Crossfade in, crossfade out. Yeah, there you go. So it could be that once you get used to it, that maybe it's almost as nice as a real DAW. I don't know. I don't want to oversell it, but I've used it as a heck of an audio editor.
It looks to me like if you did that and you found a successful fade length, like... 20 milliseconds or some random number off the top of my head. You can do a repeat control R function on the next one, and it will automatically do the same thing.
I don't even know what it just did.
It just did it.
Just crossfaded the whole thing.
It just crossfaded. I wanted to see what the dialogue looked like, and it didn't. There is no dialogue. It just did something. I'm not sure what it was doing. So it's guaranteed to be worth what you pay for it. And hopefully it can do what you want. It's worth just getting a copy and playing around with it, really.
Do the menu items have mouse over identifiers? Like if you click, no, not in the pull-down menus, but up in the icon menu.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
If you hold over something, does it tell you what it does?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's helpful.
Right. And if you go into the edit preferences, you can bind all your own hotkeys. You can bind mouse behaviors you want. So there's a lot of room for personalization to make it do what you want it to do.
That's cool.
So again, I'm not an audio producer, and I have not used the heck out of this, and I don't really know its strengths and failures for that. But I've used it to make a lot of. I've used it to make a lot of test tracks. Like sometimes I want test tracks where I want to take a frequency out, or I want to just do a demo of just an interesting part of the music and just snip that out and do the fade in, fade out. So my needs are relatively simple, but it has never let me down. It's a useful program.
Can you import or export these surround formats, your DTS thing, or Dolby AC3?
No. It doesn't have that. Now, it does have plugins, and it has its own, you know, Nyquist plugins, which is just a list of Nyquist commands to execute, but it also does something called LADSPA and something called VST.
Mm-hmm.
So, are those good?
They're just a kind of plugin. They're the new end of plugin.
LADSPA's more of a Linux based.
Okay. And apparently there's a LADSPA plugin, which is a wrapper for VST plugins. So by using that, it can do the whole universe of VSTs.
Right. VST is like, plugins for half the DAWs out there. I mean, or for Windows. Or, you know, everybody would poke it.
So there's actually a lot of features. I was actually, when I started preparing for this talk, I was surprised because I hadn't really opened all the menus and scrolled through them a lot in recent time. And, you know, I'd started with this like 4 years ago, and 4 years ago it was smaller and didn't have as much, especially in the effects. You know, all these things, some guy like me could just sit down and write an effect and just donate it, and they don't even have to have the core team doing it. And so over time they just accumulate more and more. Like I said, the low-pass filter, I had no idea, because a couple of years ago or 4 years ago when I first looked at the low-pass filter, what it had was lame. It was not very useful. And they used to have this thing they called FFT filter where you could just draw a curve, and I'm just like, I'm just using that. I never even used the low-pass filter. It was better to just draw the curve I wanted. But they have a real low-pass filter here now, and then they have the equalization tool, which is actually more sophisticated than the old FFT filter thing. It just keeps getting better over time. One of the cool things about free software is that the people who are working on it, they're just focused on solving the problem. If there's two ways to do it and one of them's better, they want to do it the better way. Sometimes in commercial software, there's a tension. If you make it too good, you give up money. Like, maybe you'll have the cheap version and the expensive version. The expensive version does stuff the cheap one doesn't. In the free software world, they don't have that tension. It's just, if there's an obvious solution, they just do it. So there are times, I won't slam commercial software because I get paid to write it, you know. There are times, though, when sometimes the free software is better than the commercial stuff because there is no disincentive for solving the problem the right way. You know, if Adobe Audition could make like the last version you'd ever need, you would never have any reason to upgrade. And they would have a disincentive to actually release that. Whereas if these guys figured out some way to make every feature you'd ever need, then they would just do it.
So it seems like the one limitation would be that anything that's licensed would be unlikely to be in here.
Like ASIO, for example.
MP3s in here, are they licensing that?
There's some kind of a generosity thing where if you're doing free software, you can just sort of use MP3. I'm not sure how it works. With MP3, as with the other formats, they have terms of licensing. And depending on what you want to do, they charge different amounts. And apparently there's some kind of a provision for MP3, at least at this point in time, where if you're doing free stuff, they'll just let you have it.
Well, more to the point, any of the encoders made before 1992 aren't patented anymore.
Well, probably not. So the patents, the way they used to work is... you got 17 years of protection from the date the patent was granted. So then what some individuals or companies would do was they would file an application so the patent is pending, but they would use any tricks and games they could think of to delay the actual granting. So they would have the pending period as long as possible to push out the final grant period as long as possible. And then once they finally lost that fight and got it granted, then they would have 17 years from that point.
Yeah, but now it's also 20 years from the time of filing maximum.
Strangely, that was right where I was going. they've changed it so that from now on, you know, from late 1990s, I think, and afterward, it's 20 years from the date of filing, just to avoid those games. So presumably, you would think that when they made that change, they would have also fixed it so that anything that was in the hang fire stage would be automatically forced into the new regime and would just start the clock ticking at 20. But apparently not so. So theoretically, there could be a patent out there that is still in the pending phase, it hasn't been granted, and when it finally gets granted, it will be 17 years. Theoretically. I don't think that's true. So theoretically, there could be something from the early 90s that would eventually take effect. Yes?
They also changed the way the duration works on the patent, and that you have to pay what they call a maintenance fee periodically. So I think it's every 5 years or something. And if you don't pay that fee, then your patent just automatically goes public domain. So you lose the patent protection, and there's no going back.
Right.
You can't call your shark and say, I didn't mean to. Fix that, please. Oh, sorry.
So in that way, strangely, patents are now sort of less liberal than copyright. It used to be that copyright was you had to file for it. You had to, like, send notification to the Library of Congress, and then you would get it for, I think, 16 years, and then you could renew it one time, and then you'd get another 16 years, and after that, it was absolutely public domain. And now you don't have to register it. You don't ever have to renew it. It's good for the life of the creator of the work plus 75 years. And that 75 years thing is just long enough that the early Disney cartoons aren't in the public domain yet. And people are suspecting that as soon as, you know, Steamboat Willie, the first Mickey Mouse cartoon, is about to lapse in the public domain, that Disney's going to get busy with the Congress and try to get copyright law pushed out even further. I personally think copyright law is a three-corner deal between the government, the people, and the content creators. And the deal is no longer very good for the people anymore. The deal is that the government acts as an enforcer for free to enforce all these rights. And then as part of that deal, at the end of the term, it lapses into the public domain so the people get this gift. And right now, you don't get the gift for the life of the creator plus 75 years. And that's not really what I have in mind when I think of a limited time, which is what the Constitution says. So anyway, patents are now a much shorter window than copyright. And then the worst case is if you simply put an encryption scheme on something, no matter how laughably poor it is, and that never lapses because the DMCA has no time limit on it. So I can add 3 to every byte in my file and say, now it's encrypted. And that's laughably stupid. You subtract 3 from everything, and you've got the original back. but it's encrypted, and now it's illegal for you to reverse that, and the illegality never changes. And, you know, so that's better than copyright, even. You just put something in an encrypted format, and it's locked down forever under DMCA. And I'm hoping that will get changed.
You just made a pencil and paper illegal.
What?
You just made a pencil and paper illegal.
Well, instead of me rambling, how about questions? Is there any questions?
I'm still confused about the relationship between extreme limiting and distortion. Were you able to tell that that Mars Volta thing was digitally distorted because that you were looking at it at such fine resolution that it was flattened there?
All I did was open the file and look at it at a fine magnification. Because Audacity will go all the way down to samples. And especially if you select the pencil tool, it lights up the samples as little dots. So over here, this looks like a brick wall. So let's zoom this in. And we'll zoom in again. And just zoom, zoom, zoom. And just my luck, this part doesn't look so bad. Okay, well. Here's a bad part.
Okay, yeah, use that one.
So
that's digital distortion right there. Well, there's no way that that's analog.
The fact that it's actually ruler flat means that it wound up being implemented digitally, but an analog would never be quite ruler flat.
Right. So that's how you tell.
But it could have happened. See, the thing is you could also make a soft clipper. You can't tell really certainly whether it's digital or analog clipping, but the only way you can really tell if it's analog clipping is if you have something that's clean enough that you can find out if there's aliasing components in the spectrum. If there's aliasing components in the spectrum, it was digitally clipped. If there isn't, it's analog clipping. But that's really the only way you can tell, and that only happens with a simple enough spectrum that you can actually analyze it.
I would suggest trying it with a sine wave and turning it up until we hear that there's actually a distortion product.
It's taking this pre-recorded thing and saying this is, because it's so wall-to-wall on the thing that's automatically distorted.
I can redo my demo for you just real quick. We'll say generate a tone, and it'll be a 440. And then what we're going to do, we'll select everything, and we're going to amplify it. Now again, by checking this box, I allow clipping.
Right.
So I'm going to put way too much on it so that... So now, when I... The cool part here is that when I look at it, it looks fine when I plot the spectrum. And this is because, internally, Audacity is doing everything in float. And if I saved this in float, it would actually be okay.
Right.
I'm not sure what would happen when you tried to play it back, like in Windows Media Player.
It would probably happen, wouldn't it?
Well, it depends on what it does, but it would probably.
Well, actually, no. In Vista and Windows 7, the limiter, actually, you helped write a long time ago.
I was wondering.
Would kick in, and what it would do is because the whole stream is floating point in Vista and Windows 7, had to put a limiter at the input to every input to the audio engine and at the output. And there's two things that happen. If it's less than 12 dB large, it will just basically do a fast hard limit, which is to say it'll pull the gain down and just keep the gain constant so that you're not clipping. If you get above 4 dB at the input, the engine will look at the stream and say, scoot! Basically, if you see anything bigger than plus or minus 4 at the input of the audio engine, it's assuming that it's somebody trying to break through volume control. The reason for this is that if you don't do this and you have the volume control set to the next off level, somebody can make a pop-up that says Via Viagra now and have it running at a plus or minus a million. And that will blow through the entire system and come out at maximal level. So what happens is when you put this limiter at the input, it just takes those things and just says, go away. Scram. Go away. So that's why it's set up that way. That's what Windows will do. I have no idea what
it mutes.
If you have something over plus or minus 4, it just says this stream is defective. Go away. It doesn't mute. It just basically kills the stream.
Well, what's the difference?
Killing the stream means that
Muting means that you could continue to get something and you might be able to unmute it. Killing the stream means it cuts the the program connection. Goodbye, so long.
So this is the central audio manager, and there's different streams coming from different places. Like, let's say you've got the media player playing a song while you work, and then your instant messenger pops up and makes a little ringtone sound because somebody sent you a message. That gets mixed in. And then the pop-up in the web browser pops up and says, buy Viagra. And what he's saying is they used these games we're talking about with, like, floating point values with really, really large sample values.
So it drowns everything out.
And so just a naive thing would just be to mix everything in, and then even if you had a naive limiter, it would go, oh, look, this thing is, like, plus or minus 4 million. So we'll just gain it down until it's plus or minus 1, and then everything else gets squished away to nothing, and then this thing's full wave, and it's as loud as it could be.
You're done.
You're permanently done. That's the problem.
Yeah. Right. So in this case, like I said, it's hard to know for sure what would happen. And what he's saying is, in this case, if you had, like, plus or minus 4 million, it would just knock that stream on the head and say, that stream has lost its playing privileges. And the other things continue to get mixed. Your music keeps playing, the music player, and everything.
So you wouldn't hear that pop-up.
Right, that was the
whole goal. Would you not hear that? Most programs will crash. Your browser will throw out the pop-up. We'll take a look at the pop-up and tell it, and, you know, and mail home to the mothership that there's something wrong with the pop-up. I mean,
and before they stuck this in, there were cases where it happened, right?
Well, only in the pre-release Vista. I mean, there were people who insisted it would never happen. Somebody from Czechoslovakia was there in a week. Literally. It was really sort of annoying.
So anyway, so what we're doing here is we have a floating point number, and the floating point number is like scientific notation. You know, you have like 2.3 times 10 to the 9, and you can change the 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 10. You can like redraw the exponent and draw bigger and bigger numbers. Floating point lets you do that. Whereas integer math has just a finite range. In the case of 16-bit, it's the numbers from about 32,700-something to minus 32,700-something are all the possible values you have. That's all you get. So a full wave, you know, full amplitude wave swings between plus 32,000-whatever and minus 32,000-whatever, and that's all you get. So what happens if you take something in this format, the 16-bit digital format, and you apply a gain to it? As long as it's not full wave, you might get away with it. If it's only half wave and you apply a gain of 2, it becomes full wave and you don't lose anything. But once you push it beyond what it can be represented, all it can do is saturate. If you take a number that's 31,000 and you multiply it by a gain of 4, all they can do is just set it up to the max, which is 32,000, and then you're losing the waveness. You know, the part that would have gone up above the line is just sliced right off. And
actually, that's what happens. That's the good thing that you can do. The other thing that happens is things that just mask off the most significant bits, and it wraps. And that's even worse. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't think anybody would ship code like that.
I won't name any AC97 codecs that did that, okay?
Okay. So.
But it would be a real wreck.
So, according to what I've read about the loudness war, you didn't have a really big problem with the loudness war in the time of analog LPs because there were limits on what you can carve physically into a vinyl album, and there are limits to what... If you pushed it too hard, the needle might jump right out of the track on playback. And so there's these physical limits that limited how badly they could abuse the system. And with CDs, there are no such limits. CDs, you basically are getting a bunch of little numbers burned into a laser. And so... if a evil record exec says, turn the gain up some more, even though it's already as high as it should go, and you turn the gain up some more, then all that can happen is it can slice it off. Or I guess the worst case is that it wraps around and silly things happen. Either way, you're going to get noise. It's going to sound bad. And that's the whole deal with the loudness war. And I am personally hoping that... I read about an article that said Apple was going to maybe have iTunes have like super high quality music available, like 24-bit instead of 16-bit. Now, we don't need dynamic range. most of, like the Mars Volta, they're not using any dynamic range. You plot the dynamic range and it goes from zero to max, and there's nothing in between. So you could represent that with this many bits. So you're not using the dynamic range you've got. So we don't need that, but I'm hoping that maybe if we have this super high quality 24-bit format, that maybe they'll have the normal version, which they can max the gain and clip and sound terrible, and then maybe for the 24-bit version they won't. That somehow they'll...
That's actually what they've done in SACD. A lot of SACDs, the CD layer is compressed to crap, and the SACD layer isn't. And then the manufacturer says, look, the SACD sounds better. Yeah, it does. I can say a lot about that, but they would be short words from the Saxon.
But it doesn't sound louder. It sounds better, but it doesn't sound louder.
It sounds better. Sounds better.
DC. I mean,
where's
the low end cutoff on the output of this thing? I mean, when you run the signal up against a rail, whether it's analog or digital, basically if it's flat, it's DC. I mean, you got some high frequency stuff that makes it turn the corner, but then it's DC, and then you got some high frequency stuff that makes it turn the corner again. So if it won't put out DC, you don't hear the flat as DC.
Well,
here it is, some silence, or what do you? I mean, what do you?
Maybe
most speakers don't do DC
maybe
very well. They basically slew trying.
Maybe what we should do is do a talk sometime on introduction to Fourier analysis, which would answer your question, but I can't answer it in 30 seconds.
It's not that simple.
It's just not that
and
simple.
And then you get the speakers involved.
Well, even if you assume the whole system is linear, it's not that simple.
Right.
Because it's up there for a certain duration and it goes down for a certain duration. And because it does have changes in it, it's not DC. DC is defined as eternally from the beginning of time to the end of time, one value.
If you just looked at that, the sample that's rammed up against the one there.
Yeah.
And it's flat.
Oh, it's flat.
That's DC.
And by
that
the
amount of time,
it's not DC.
It's a voltage.
It's a voltage, but it's not DC because it does have changes. The other thing is, it's not quite true. If you look at an analog clip, you will see slightly soft edges, typically. Saturation, even with a high feedback audio amplifier, there's a little range of decreased gain before it goes flat.
Yes.
And with digital, there's no such thing.
It's just flat.
The other thing, if you take analog clipping and run it into a digital capture, it won't be flat anymore because all of the frequencies above the Nyquist frequency will be filtered out, and so now you see ripples in the flat. So if you filter, and the lack of those ripples is why you get all that ghostly aliasing in digital. Because what you've done is you cannot generate a signal above half the sampling rate in digital. But what happens if you try, you generate something at half the sampling rate plus X, it comes out at half the sampling rate minus X. So what happens is when you take that 20 kilohertz, you know, you wind up with something at 40 kilohertz. So it comes out at 24 minus 40, 16 kilohertz. And so on. And the reason for that 2011 being a prime number,
but what level?
Well, that depends on the waveform. But typically, if you notice there was a set of lines going down like this at about 6 dB per octave, then a set going down like this at about 6 dB per octave, and back and forth like this. The reason for that is because when you turn something into a square wave, it rolls off at 6 dB per octave. If you looked at Mars Volta, you notice it just rolled, except for a little bump with some processing, you notice it just rolled off at 6 dB per octave the whole time. And the reason it rolled off at 6 dB per octave the whole time is because they turned it into square waves.
Except for the voice, which when you look at the whole envelope, you see the voice in the middle.
Yeah.
So they're using the dynamic range.
Well.
But they're using it differently than you would like them to.
If you think about it, during the times when
it's
saturated.
When you amplified it, you forgot to check the box.
But if you forget something, when you're in the saturated parts, the voice is gone because it's flat. So for those parts of the waveforms where it peaks, there is no voice. It's being switched on and off.
Right.
And if you've ever done modulation theory, you know, switching something on and off creates what?
Noise.
It's
my man.
Stuff. Is the, I mean, well, the answer is sideband, but when you're doing it with a random, not irregular signal, stuff. Yeah, stuff is probably a noise. A four-letter word that describes stuff.
So I just redid the prime number. So here's the spectrum.
And you can see this is first, third. You notice you're down 12, 12, 12, 12, 12, and just keeps going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. That's what you're seeing. And it's not quite exactly 12 here because we didn't actually generate a square wave. There's still a little bit of curve between the plus and minus.
Correct.
Well,
it's distortion.
It's distortion.
It's just a lot of noise.
Well, actually, no, it's periodic, so it's not noise.
It's highly correlated.
Finally correlated.
Correlated.
It's signal correlated.
We could definitely call it John.
Put to sleep.
Ouch. Your both legs awake?
One's asleep.
This is very good. Yeah.
Thank
you.
So we meet again.
Wow. Do we have more questions here?
No.
I think maybe we're going to follow you out, Bob.
It's amazing to me that it appears from this that the maximum dynamic range of this monster that we've created is about 40 decibels or so, give or take a couple, since 20K isn't really showing up at zero on the graph, at least not at that zoom resolution.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like 40 decibels of dynamic range is still pretty good.
But this is really this is spectral dynamic range.
Yeah.
I mean, there's different ways to define dynamic range. There's spectral tilt, which defines dynamic range.
Yeah.
There's change of time, which can define dynamic range. It can be a long-term average versus a short-term average. There's a lot of different ways to... There's a problem with... One of the problems with the term dynamic range is it's defined.
It's vague.
But, you know, this goes down to about 36, 42. I guess that's about 39. Yeah. And that's at about minus 9. So this is about 30 dB here. But that's a spectral tilt, not, strictly speaking, a dynamic range. And what is a dynamic range? Actually, one of these things, you know, in my spare time someday, I'd actually like to write a freeware measurement suite. But then probably the guys at Audio Precision would throw bricks at me or something. But I can do it all with stuff that was published in 1960.
Free software with the purchase of a piece.
So we could also do this instead of 16-bit with 24-bit, and we'd have probably more dynamic range. It would still be clipped.
Well, you'd still see the same overall spectrum. You can try it.
So we undo the format change, and this time, say, set samples to 24-bit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I didn't gain it high enough. We'll see.
So you get the same. You're going to get the same spectrum. It's just you get more accuracy down here in the same spectrum.
More accurate junk.
You get more accurate garbage. Yes. You just made the garbage at least. Well, let's see. 8 times 6 is 48 dB more accurate.
Right.
So it's 48 dB more accurate garbage.
Well, if there's no more questions, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.